This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to the Philosopher's Zone. You know what? That's not true. But it kind of is true, if you know what I mean. That's me clumsily trying to introduce the topic for today's Minefield, where we try to negotiate the ethical and moral dilemmas of modern life. Waleed Ali, my name, Scott Stevens, my co-host. And Scott, was I being honest or dishonest at the top of the show there?
Very nice. You've just done layer upon layer there, haven't you?
I have. I mean, it was not true, but maybe it was truer.
Oh, my goodness. Okay.
Truer than if I'd just said it was the Minefield. Okay. You know what I'm saying?
Now it's just getting ridiculous. Yeah. Well, we are, in fact, as a matter of fact, we are doing today a topic that is as old as philosophy itself. And who would have thought that a figure as distinctly modern as Donald Trump would throw us back, what, some 2,400 years onto one of the central preoccupations of Plato, namely the relationship, the peculiar, I should say, relationship between politics and truth, or the interrelationship between truth and lies within the political vocation. I mean, you would agree, wouldn't you, Waleed, that one of the central things that I think the Trump presidency or the Trump candidacy and then the presidency has thrown up for us, one of its defining characteristics, is the casual relationship that he has with, let's call them, facts.
Yep.
That he can contradict himself, he can revise his story with seemingly little internal mental friction between mutually contradictory statements. But I do wonder, and I'm interested to see what you think about this. I do have philosophical friends, and they're real ones, not the usual imaginary ones I talk about.
Oh, right.
Who say that you can't call what Trump does lying. Because
okay, so can I think I know where you're going.
Yeah.
Can I just say, I don't think we should just make this about Trump. I think you can put the Pauline Hanson phenomenon in similar basket here, because you see, for example, her setting new world records for changing positions on things and then proceeding as though she hasn't and all that sort of, I mean, business tax cuts was perhaps the most recent example of that, but there seem to be a lot of cases of that sort of thing. And I think you might even be able to argue about the relationship between truth and politics within major parties as well. I think we're looking at something that's a new sort of phenomenon, a new take on dishonesty or honesty, as the case may be. So I just want to put that caveat in now, but I want you to finish the thought that you
had
as well.
Yeah, look, well, on that point, I think what's interesting then is that dishonesty can be rolled into a certain political persona as long as that dishonesty is underwritten by a certain authenticity. In other words, truth no longer becomes veracity or even facticity. Truth becomes something like the shedding of mere appearances or the shedding of ideology. It becomes straight talking. It becomes of telling things like it is, or even standing. I should say, one of the most interesting things I think you've ever said on this show, you said in the aftermath of Trump's election, where you said the fundamental thing that was put to the American people was that Hillary Clinton may well say this or that true statement, but for many Americans, she stands for the great big capital L lie, whereas Trump might say this or that small L lie, and yet for many Americans, he stands for a kind of capital T truth in the sense of authenticity.
And sort of a preparedness to unveil the system and the way that the system works to screw. So, yeah, for Trump supporters, Clinton was truth in the service of a system that dupes them. Whereas Trump was casual relationship with truth, but to reveal to them the way in which the system is screwing them. And that's a really important thing. I want to, by way of explanation, say that I sort of was floating this topic with you because I'd seen that some, I think it might have been some reporting from the Longman by-election, actually, that we recently had, whereby people who liked the cut of Pauline Hanson's jib or were minded to vote in One Nation's direction would say, whether they all agreed with Pauline Hanson or not, at least she's honest. And I think you would get a very similar response from Trump supporters, that they would say that, well, we regard him as honest, even though it's hard to recall two politicians who've been more dishonest in that microscopic sense, really, of being prepared to say things that are just made up or untrue or whatever the case may be that leads them to say things that are not factually accurate. And I think that's new. I know you're saying that this is an old philosophical conversation, but I think that's a new phenomenon in politics, isn't it? That we've come to regard honesty and dishonesty, or at least a portion of these electorates have come to regard honesty and dishonesty in this way. It's sort of a new concept of dishonesty and honesty, isn't it?
Well, you see, here's where I don't think it is all that new. I mean, there is something peculiar about the way in which authenticity is valorized, is almost turned into a kind of fetish or a brand within modern politics. I think there's something peculiar about that. But the idea that truth isn't necessarily factuality, the idea that there is a kind of varied character to truth, that there are different types of truth, if you like, not so much truths in the sense that everyone has their own truth, but that truth itself can't simply be described as a statement of fact or something that corresponds to the way in which things are. So, for instance, you would have to say that truth within a democracy is a very, very fragile idea. I mean, if we were to fall back, for instance, on something like a technocracy, where you have experts whose job it is to be in possession of all the relevant facts and then make supremely rational utilitarian decisions on the basis of the facts that are at hand, then you have something peculiar. You have a political system that's defensible in a certain sense, but you don't necessarily have a democratic system, do you? As soon as you have a democratic system of governance where legitimacy comes from the periodic staging of elections and people weighing into particular political platforms or priorities that they want to privilege over a period of time, then you have a different conception of truth, not truth in the absolute or factual sense, but truth in the sense of competing visions of the way in which the world is. You wouldn't call this relative truth, but I think you could call it relational truth. These are truths, if you like, that need to be tempered by being brought into conversation with other perspectives upon the world. Then you have the truth, I think, that's being represented by politicians like Donald Trump. This idea that they represent a kind of underlying profound realization. They represent an underlying fact about the world that's not being spoken or that's being covered over by fairly perfidious lies. I mean, that is a kind of almost like the truth of revelation, or almost a kind of affective truth, the truth that appeals to pure sentiment or the reality of people's daily lives. So I think one of the things we do need to do, and Plato is very aware of this, that when you talk about the relationship of truth and politics, truth in the realm of political decision-making and governance, truth isn't the same as, if you like, metaphysical truth or the truth of scientific theorems or geometric theorems. I think there we're immediately in very interesting and historically rich philosophical territory.
Yeah, okay. I'm happy to accept that. The only... I think there's a more colloquial way of describing what we're trying to talk about here. And I wonder if the discerning factor that makes someone appear truthful despite not saying factually correct things, and perhaps even pursuing lines of argument that are deceptive, downright deceptive in some cases. And I would put a lot of Trump and even Hansen's discourse on migration and immigrants into that category, right? But I wonder if the mark of this concept of truth and honesty is a preparedness to wear heat for it. So in other words, the preparedness of somebody to say the unutterable and then be smashed for it, the fact of them being smashed becomes the evidence of their truthfulness. Whereas once upon a time, it might have been the opposite, that if someone was being smashed for saying something, that that was regarded as some kind of embryonic, at least, evidence for what they said not being true. But as you've seen a huge decline in the esteem in which mainstream institutions have been held, from major political parties and the establishments within those parties through to mainstream media, and then even other, you know, mainstream institutions like universities or whatever, as a product of incessant culture warring over however many decades. As you've seen that decline, the mere fact of being assailed from all directions becomes ipso facto evidence of truthfulness. Because why would you say it? If, you know, you're prepared to make the sacrifice for pursuing this truth. And I wonder, the reason that I think that this sounds so often in the context of somebody saying something that breaches the kind of holy trinity of racism, sexism, homophobia, is that I wonder if it speaks to something in the lived experience of people where they feel they've said things that now they would be assailed for saying, but within themselves don't really regard them as being so egregious. That is, they just see themselves as being honest and not necessarily hostile or antagonistic or anything like that. They think of themselves as being well-meaning, but they now see a world that assails them for it. And so when they see a public figure emerge who is prepared to say these things and then wear the heat, they're tapping into a kind of visceral, you know, almost existential honesty that they feel is being lost in the way that they're being assailed by the new discursive norms of society. I haven't fully thought this through, and I'm partly informed here by a really interesting conversation I had with a politician from a major party about this phenomenon. So it's not a fully formed idea, but I wonder if there's something there. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I have loads of thoughts on it. I'm not sure how much time to give to it, but I mean, there is absolutely something incredibly affectively powerful when a sentiment that one holds, and one might even hold in secret, or one has been reviled for in private, to have that given a kind of official statement, there is a process of recognition that happens there. It's no wonder that the sort of people who do tend to affix their political platforms so much to their own personalities, to their own personal travails, to their own struggles in life, and to their own willingness to come out on top despite the odds, or even just to survive despite being attacked on all sides. The fact that that these kinds of authentic politicians are then able to clutch their biographies to their own breast and to kind of use that as one of the platforms on which they make their political appeal, that itself, I think, becomes a kind of interesting way of almost incorporating, you know, use that in kind of Hegel's, we are doing Philosopher's Zone, in Hegel's, you know, very strong sense of incorporation, where you have a figure who embodies the totality, almost a kind of messianic figure. Yes, we see ourselves in that person. In that sense, it's the body of that authentic leader. The truth that they stand for is really the truth of my own affirmation, the truth of my own recognition in a time where I'm being attacked on all other sides. And there's something very, very powerful about that, that longing for recognition, that longing for a degree of commonality and community. There's something, I think, powerful about that. At the same time, you'd also have to say that that is a debauched form of solidarity. It's a debauched form of community because it renounces that fundamental character of truthfulness, which is the willingness to be communicative, which is the willingness to not simply gather together in a common, a common body of mutual adherence of a particular platform, but to open oneself up to other people and to being responded to open oneself up to riposte.
Yeah, I would just say that's the mark of our age. I think it happens in response to a communicative environment, as well as helping create that communicative environment that's not communicative at all and not persuasive. This is The Minefield. My name is Karl Stefanovic, and my co-host is Aristotle. See, more truth through the medium of lies. You can listen to the show on the radio. You might be doing that right now. You can catch us anytime on the ABC Listen app. You can also subscribe to our podcast, which comes with extra content wherever it is you do such podcasts. All of those statements after our names was literally true. You can bank on that. Scott.
Our guest is one of our all-time favorites. Danielle Sellermeyer is Professor of Sociology and Social Policy at University of Sydney. And there's some times, Danny, where we just feel like, you know, the whole reason we bring you onto the show is because you channel Hannah Arendt. And Arendt, of all modern philosophers, I think, was one of the most perceptive about the relationship, the complex, the fraught relationship between truth and politics in our time. So I might just sort of let you kick off at exactly that point. For Arendt, can truth in politics be simply substituted for kind of commitment to facts?
So firstly, it's lovely to be back. Hello, both of you. Arendt opened one of her essays on truth and politics with the line that truth has never been a friend to politics. And let's just unpack what she meant by that. What she meant by that, and I think it's helpful to lay out a bit of a geography of truth, which is what I think you were trying to do earlier. I'll just move into that a little further. What she was saying is that if we take truth in the Platonic sense of being metaphysical truth, these absolute truths that stand over and above the converse between human beings, and that what we ought to do in our social and political lives is coordinate ourselves with those absolute truths, whether this is what justice is, this is what freedom is, this is what the ideal human being is, then what we do is we destroy the unique dignity of what goes on between human beings, because we're only at best approximating that higher truth. And so to make space for politics, which you were gesturing towards before, Scott, when you talked about the perspectival nature of the diversity of truths that we bring from how we look onto the common world from our unique places, and then we bring that together to create this, the shared world, which is the human world, that requires that we bracket those absolute truths, because otherwise we don't have space for the unique dignity of human truth. So that was one type of geography of truth that she related to politics.
It is worth pointing out, by the way, that, I mean, for Aristotle, I realize you moving away from Plato to Aristotle is a little bit heretical, but for Aristotle, simply imposing metaphysical truths onto human politics, that is totalitarianism.
Well, that's where Arendt's coming from. So Arendt's much more of an Aristotelian than she is a Socratic thinker, although she's a Socratic thinker, not a Platonic thinker. I won't go there. And we're not on the philosopher's zone. But yes, so very much she does see that as the seeds of totalitarianism. And then we might take that a step further, that it's not just a totalitarian political form in the form of Stalinism that has a theory of absolute history, or Nazism that has a theory of nature that moves in a particular direction, and that what we mere citizens need to do is be coordinated by our leaders to move along that path towards truth. It's also in universal truths about what the ideal human being is, or what the ideal form of institutional arrangements is, that squeeze out the diversity that is the stuff of democratic politics. At the same time, and I think this is the most critical intervention for our age, she argued strongly, and I argue strongly, that in the absence of fidelity to facts, that creation or that creative realm of the multiple perspectival truths is not possible. Because facts have this ambiguous status. They're simultaneously outside human control. Is there a door in the room that I'm sitting in? Did you just hit me in the face? Those things either happened or they didn't happen. At the same time, if we're not faithful to them after they occur, if we don't continue to tell them as they were, then they're imminently fragile. They're completely fragile. And so Arendt thought that if we don't have a fidelity to factual truth, then this other type of human truth, which is the truth of a pluralistic democratic politics, can't flourish. One more thing, and I want to move to the conversation that you two were having about, do we have old concepts of truth that we can move up back to, or is there something historical happening? I think there's truth in what both of you are saying. But there is something historical happening, and that is the entry into politics of the wholesale lie. So it's not just that we have the incidental lie, but it's that the distinction between truth and falsity itself is what has been destroyed. And I think that we can look broadly outside politics to the rise of reality TV, if we want to look into the realm of media, if we want to look into the realm of philosophy and sociology, the way in which post-structuralism has challenged the domination of absolute truths. So we're in this time now, and I do think it's a new time, where the very distinction between what a truth and lie is has really been destabilized, such that we're not standing on solid ground anymore. Hmm. And Arendt said quite beautifully, and for that there is no remedy. Hmm. But the other thing which I think is critical for understanding our historical moment is she also said that I'll quote her, the surest long-term result of brainwashing, or this destruction of the distinction between truth and lies is cynicism. And I think that's what you were getting at, Waleed, when you were talking about the sense that there is an honesty here, that in the face of cynicism, they're just lying to us all the time. There's a search for a different type of truth, which you're calling authenticity, which has a type of affective ring or an emotional ring with people who are lost in this sea of truth, untruth.
Hmm. Mm. The thing I would say, though, is that the new truth that is being offered isn't post-structuralist, really, is it? It's not that it denies the existence of a bigger truth. It's that it asserts that the bigger truth is being shielded from you, and that we will now offer this. And to the extent that we articulate it that way, I do wonder how new that is now, because I think about all manner of ideological movements and orientations that have made that kind of move, probably in the 20th century seems replete with them, you know. But any kind of revolution, it seems to me, makes a similar sort of argument, doesn't it?
I think that's right. And I exposed myself on Friday night to watching some YouTube videos on QAnon, because I thought I better be a little familiar with what's going on. For the listeners who don't know, QAnon is the new conspiracy movement that's happening in the United States. And what's so interesting about QAnon, as is the case with most conspiracy movements, is it has enough truth to hook you.
And the core
truth of QAnon is we are being duped. We are being duped. We've been duped for a long time. And there are saviors or a savior who is coming to reconnect us with the truth by agreeing with us that we're being duped. So I don't think it's a post-structuralist truth. I think it's a post-structuralist truth.
There's something, I mean, this is why, incidentally, the history of conspiracy and the history of democracy weave in and out of one another so profoundly. Democracy, in a very real way, creates these kind of networks of meaning that always make one suspicious of what it is or who it is that's going to try to seize power illegitimately or try to freeze us out of the decision-making process. Can I just go back, though, Danny, just to one very quick thing that you mentioned? When Arendt talks about facts, even in the way that you narrated it, these aren't just facts as in what it is that may well be happening or the demographic makeup of whatever or rates of immigration. I mean, Arendt seems to talk about facts almost in terms of historical facts. If they're not accurately narrated, they are lost. They are flimsy. They need to be turned into words, into narrative, in order for those words then to become common words, in order for the facts themselves to become one of the necessary forms of language that we then have to communicate reasonably with one another.
Yes, that's right. So facts exist in history only in the moment when they're occurring, and then their preservation enters into the realm of language and narration, and so it becomes our responsibility. I mean, on that, I just want to go back to the conversation where Waleed was talking about the way in which a certain way of speaking true, speaking politically and correctly resonates. I think there it's very important to distinguish between where political figures lie about facts and where political figures, we might say, tell moral lies. And so there's a difference between saying 2 million Sri Lankan refugees tried to get into Australia last year and saying Sri Lankan refugees are potential terrorists or all Muslims are X. I think it's very important to distinguish between one which is subject to moral contestation, even though we might feel that there are certain moral truths, but there is moral contestation, and one which is actually about what happened in the world. And I don't think that we do ourselves service by conflating those. I think they do different sorts of work, and their disruption has different sorts of roots.
Yeah, but when you put those two examples together, I think there's an interesting discussion about which one is more pernicious, actually.
Well, the lie about the historical truth is what nourishes the lie about the moral truth or the moral statement, I would say.
There's an iterative relationship between
them. But the moral statement is the thing that gives the historical statement its meaning. It provides the kind of historical frame within which that becomes not just a statement of fact, but rather...
Absolutely. The truth is
we have no time to prosecute this now on the radio show, so we're going to have to expand upon it in the podcast element. Danielle, it's a joy as always, and I'm glad to say that joy is not yet over for those of us who are listening on the podcast. So thank you very much for your time.
Thanks.
Danielle Selemeyer is a Professor of Sociology and Social Policy at the University of Sydney, our guest for this week's radio portion of The Minefield. We'll see you next week for that and on the podcast right now.
One of the things that I'm so sorry for being the one that brings Trump back into the discussion, but there is something almost archetypal about the way that he responds to uncomfortable statements of seeming fact, whether it be about when he knew about a meeting between his son and members of his political campaign and certain Russian representatives, or what he knew about payments that were made to women that were being paid to keep silent. One of the interesting things about his response to these things, the kind of incidental knee-jerk way in which he engages in denial, is that his forms of deceit seem to be self-protective. And this, again, goes a long way back in the philosophy of, or the history of the philosophy of lying itself, that deceit is fundamentally a form of self-protection. It's a way of closing oneself off from the claim or the shared responsibilities or shared obligations that we have among us. There's a very famous Christian medieval philosopher who called lying a form of verbal fornication. It becomes a way of turning something that ought to be common and pure, common in the sense of being shared among people and sort of open towards another.
I thought fornication was quite shared and open to the other.
Fornication in the sense of turning it back onto oneself. So Augustine said in Incurvatus, say turning it back into my own, into my own use.
And can I just interpose here, though, Scott? Without, you don't need to embellish upon this, but that seems to me a very good reason for why the person who puts themselves in a position of being kicked in the head for what they say,
yes,
gets regarded as truthful, irrespective of the truthfulness of the content that they utter, because they're not engaged in what appears, at least outwardly, to be a form of self-protection. They're engaged in the opposite of that. And therefore, the dishonesty of self-protection must be, we must be seeing the opposite of that in that moment.
Can I make a comment on what both of you are saying? Because I wanted to speak to what you're saying, Waleed, before about authenticity.
Actually, before you do that, have we catastrophically interrupted you, Scott?
No, go, please. Go.
We can do this?
Yeah, all right, of course.
Go ahead.
Authenticity, my reference before to reality TV, has become a performance. So the type of, I'm going to say this so that you can kick me in the head, is a very inauthentic form of authenticity. I think it's very staged. I think we have to question the levels of authenticity, inauthenticity that are going on here.
That is absolutely true, yeah.
And if I want to return to what you said, Scott, because you started off by saying that Trump is self-protective in his lying, and then I think you pointed to something which is far more pernicious to that, that he's not just protecting himself from a particular narrative that's going to be harmful to his political career. It's a form of annihilation of the other.
There's an
absoluteness to the domination. And if you think about the kind of Orwellian scene of total domination, it's when you can show the other red and say, this is blue, and the other will say, yes, it's blue. So it's not only domination within the relationship, it's also domination of the world, so that the only source of truth becomes the dominating speaker. And I think that's the most pernicious dimension of this constant world making through whatever it is that comes out of my mouth in this moment, with a speed that one can't even keep up with.
Absolutely. And look, Danny, you actually got directly to my point. I mean, one of the reasons that this form of self-protection is so destructive, I think, I mean, it's not just the fact that Donald Trump has managed to dominate the world media cycle. I mean, he is the single most thought of person in the world, one would have to say. It's not just that his own large ego has come to exert its own form of gravity on modern human politics. It's the fact that the world that he then speaks, the world that he weaves, is a world in which others are rendered incommunicative. And that just, I mean, again, what really strikes me about the account that you laid about Hannah Arendt is that the nature of truth then within democratic politics is inherently fragile because it refuses those gestures of domination and it inherently opens itself up to, this is a fact, not one that I'm going to use to beat you over the head with, but this is a fact that we can then speak together as a form of common political language and through which we can then come to recognize and give proper recognition to one another.
Yeah, I think one of the aspects of your series on the unpopular virtues,
the unfashionable virtues
that I found very compelling was the way in which they formed a family. And similarly here, I think you have truth, trust, respect, equality as a type of family, that in order to be able to have this type of perspectival democratic truth, there has to be a degree of respect or forbearance towards the other, a level of trust towards the other, that I can open myself to the other's truth and be open to the other's truth, and a basic equality that we are all holders of truth and there is no one who is above the other in the right to be able to assert the truth.
This raises, Waleed, though, a really serious issue, which is, you know, the way in which fact-checking has almost become weaponized as a way of bringing down, quote-unquote, pernicious politicians. I mean, publicly stated, and especially moral lies, I think it's important that they are identified. It's important that there is a degree of public scrutiny. But
fact-checking can't do that.
No, but the weaponization of facts, I think, obscures one of the more fundamental dimensions of truth, especially within democratic politics, that simply gets overlooked. As soon as facts become weaponized, they become not a language that is shared or things around which we can together gather, but rather something that is used to demonstrate my self-righteousness, my superiority over and against your conspiracy.
Well, yes, I know exactly what you're saying. I think that's right. I think there is definitely truth to that, but it's also a response. It's a response to, particularly in a rapid-fire media environment, of the ability, the preparedness, even the shamelessness with which politicians, public figures will simply utter repeatedly untruths. Mm. Mm. And in the knowledge that if you do it often enough and frequently enough and regularly enough, that they will become facts as far as the axioms of our discourse are concerned. So, is that weaponizing or is that some kind of shield? Is it a rear guard action? And if they are weaponized, if fact-checking is weaponized, is it only weaponized because it feels that it's operating in a highly weaponized environment where the only way that this accountability can operate is for it to be asserted?
I think that's a very difficult issue you're raising because I don't think there is a choice but to point out when people lie about facts. At the same time, I think part of what happens in the fact-checking move is it feeds into a type of, this is a too crude way of putting it, but a type of class divide, right, where the fact-checkers are once again part of the technocracy, the experts, the elites who think that they've got the truth. And so what it does is it feeds into the way in which these different conceptions of truth or these different truths that people hold become proxies for the different groups that they belong to. And I don't think that we have a choice but to point out when a fact is lied about. And yet I think when we do that, we also feed into a dynamic that is in itself problematic and is independent from the status of the facts.
Okay, so this is interesting. So what I'm wondering here, this is not at all where I expected we'd end up or I would end up, but I wonder if part of the problem here is the emphasis on words. Now, so to some extent, fact-checking is about that, but In a way, when you talk about experts having some monopoly on truth, it then becomes resented by people who are not experts, and they feel that experts are telling them things that are just not true. What we're really talking about is the progressive preparedness to rely on grand ideas and theory and insights from people, from experts, from learned people, as a way of constructing and then responding to our world, as against the conservative disposition, which is to say you should not be trusting the sagacity of any individual, no matter how brilliant, to come up with theories about the world and then enact them. We need to have due deference to lived experience, accumulated tradition, and the wisdom of common people aggregated over time and in numbers in the present. And because that conservative disposition has been so marginalized, even in our political discourse. So politicians don't even really talk about that in that kind of deferential term. They have to dog whistle towards it now because that's kind of all that's left of it. That's the shell that's left of it. But other than that, they will always be talking about, here is some modeling, here is a productivity commission report on X, here is what the CSIRO says about Y. Like, if you can appeal to an authority like that, you are immediately in the game, irrespective of the historical accuracy of that modelling, for example, or whatever it might be. Because that kind of epistemology that the conservative disposition gestures towards, because that has been so sidelined from respectable political discourse, it can only ever reemerge in a form of disrespectable, or unrespectable, what is the word, political discourse that we see now. So it is actually pointing to an epistemology. It's pointing to a genuine understanding of truth. It's just that it's doing so in a debauched way. And I wonder if that's what gives it its renewed power, because the way that people who like to rely on that get policed is that they've spoken incorrectly about something. They've used the wrong word here or there. They've used a term that's impolitic, etc. And so a whole epistemology gets shut down and then can only reemerge in this mutant form.
I think that's somewhat right, but not quite right. I think that the conservative argument of the wisdom of the people is being strategically deployed, but the real dichotomy is between the elite and the excluded. And so it's not
What's
so
the
much.
Difference?
Well, I think there is a slight difference. And I think the slight difference is the way in which politics and expertise has been captured by a subset of society. They're very close, but I think they're slightly different. So conservatism is about, you know, we need to go back to the way in which institutions developed and the wisdom that is rooted in history. And this one is, you pointy heads can't put it over us. Just because you've been to Ivy League schools doesn't mean you have the truth. I think they're just slightly different.
But I still don't appreciate that.
Hang on there. This is also the difference, though, between democracy and technocracy.
Right.
So, for instance, people simply telling us what the facts are and then laying out some policy platform usually pegged to efficiency, productivity.
And presented as fact.
Yes, and then presented
as
fact.
A view.
That's right, that any rational person would then necessarily buy into. The other side, the more democratic side, I mean, you would say, wouldn't you, Danny, that here Hannah Arendt doesn't dismiss at all the conservative tradition when she says, for instance, that politicians who don't dig down deeply into the received wisdom that is embodied and reproduced among the people cannot help but skip superficially across the surface of things, that any politics that doesn't dig down into the opinion, into the values of the people, then become either spin doctors or technocrats. There you would have Arendt coming down far more on the side of the democratic limitations of both the truths of the people, but also the importance of values, which would be the more affective dimension, if you like, of democratic politics, rather than simply the facts of experts.
No, I think that's absolutely right. But let's get concrete, because when we're speaking in the abstract, it's very difficult to draw these distinctions. So I heard an interview when Trump was trying to put up his voter fraud commission, and there had been something like 40 peer-reviewed articles or studies showing that there was minimal, if any, voter fraud. And I heard someone being interviewed and they literally said, we don't need to listen to these pointy heads. We know that there's been voter fraud. Now, I would not call that the historically accrued wisdom of the people.
Agreed.
I would call that unmovable prejudice. Mm. And yep. That's the
Would you call that a moral lie?
Oh, a moral lie.
Well, it's a factual lie as well.
No, I wouldn't call it a moral lie. I would call it an unmovable prejudice.
Okay.
Hmm. And I think that's the distinction that I'm trying to draw here, that it's an unmovable prejudice which has been fed by a set of class distinctions between those who are the legitimate holders of knowledge and those who aren't, that I think is driving a lot of the dynamics that you're talking about, including the affective attractiveness to this type of authenticity of rough speech.
Hmm. Right, but see, maybe we're agreeing, actually.
I think we are.
I think that's
that
right.
That would be nice.
I think what you said is right, but what I'm saying is I think, or I at least wonder, if that is the accumulated effect of this almost systematic sidelining of accumulated wisdom of people and cultures and traditions over a period of, 30, 40 years? I'm not sure. So in other words, because that epistemology seems to have no way into respectable political discourse any longer, it shows up in this way.
So here's a really difficult question that occurs to me. What if the accumulated wisdom is profoundly racist or sexist?
Mm, that's right.
But that's the charge that's been made against conservative epistemology forever.
Does that mean it's not true?
No, it doesn't mean it's not true. But the point is that built within that epistemology is an idea that these things can kind of be organically amended. And they do become organically amended as people's experiences change and so on, right? So as they get exposure to other people or whatever it might be, it doesn't move at a pace that would satisfy progressively minded people, but it does move, which is the reason that you have social change even in conservative environments. Mm. But
this is also
to happen.
Yeah. I mean, this is also, though, Willie, why, for instance, segregation began breaking down in certain crucial places in the American South, not simply because of anti-segregation legislation, but when people really did have physical experience of being in common space. And I mean, that, in other words, is, yes, it's a more kind of organic way of bringing about these changes. But it also demonstrates the fact that, you know, when these changes do take place, they don't necessarily take place the way we would have expected them to.
Right. But because we don't have a discourse that works that way, at least not now. So what we would do now is we would make that a technocratic response, like an expert-led sort of response, particularly if we're talking about an economic thing or something, or even immigration-based stuff. We would make it that kind of response, which gives no room for either deference to sort of accumulated lived experience or even provides room for that to evolve. It's simply declared from on high. And as that happens, it just doesn't surprise me that you would then get a counter response that isn't really about accumulated experience so much as it is relying on that as a crutch to express what you've called an immovable prejudice. I just don't know that I guess what I'm saying is I think there's a reason that it takes that form now.
Oh, I think I totally agree with that. And I think this speaks back to what Scott said before about the call for recognition. You know, I think in a geography where large swathes of people have felt that their wisdom or their opinion or their perspective on the world is systematically excluded from the way in which the economy is made or politics is made or society is made, there is going to be a particularly strong call for recognition of that perspective or that set of wisdoms.
And so this is why then technocracy on the one hand and these various forms of atavistic or conspiratorial populism, they draw symbiotically upon one another. And I think what's then being missed out here, and again, you both will have to forgive me, you know, I'm still grieving the recent death of Stanley Cavell. One of the wonderful supplements that he brought to Rawls's theory of justice was this, what he called a kind of perfectionist slant to it, what he called the ongoing conversations of justice, which is you can never reach a point within a democracy where you say to another citizen within that democracy, there is nothing further I have to say to you. There is nothing further that I have to hear from you. And I know that's going to raise all sorts of questions about, well, what happens when these people live in separate moral universes, which I think is what we've been talking about now. But there has to be, surely, there has to be that kind of preparedness that, yes, these facts, yes, these opinions are fragile things, and yet this is the vernacular that we have to constantly woo one another, to kind of entice one another back into some sort of conversation.
Absolutely. And I drew a harsh distinction before between the truth of facts and the truth of meaning. But of course, they're always joined together, right? What facts are is always through the lens of the meaning that we give to those facts. And that's where the space of democratic conversation has to be kept open.
We have to end there because the technocrats upstairs have decided that they're not going to allocate us any more resources to use their lines. So, you know what? That's not actually true. Oh, I should just shut up now. Danielle, it's been enlightening as it always is. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Lovely to speak to you.